coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The start of legal recreational marijuana sales in Delaware is facing delays to its planned spring rollout.
In some ways, it's been obviously a little bit frustrating because we just don't know. We don't have a timeline.
We detail what's causing the delays and the impact in the latest edition of our Delaware's High Hope series. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also look at problems associated with out-of-school suspensions, especially for students of color. Arts Playlist visits an exhibition that transforms vintage family photos into dreamlike images. And Enlighten Me offers tips on how best to tackle spring cleaning. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Delaware issued its last round of recreational marijuana business licenses to hopeful applicants in December. But those license holders haven't begun dispensing recreational cannabis just yet. April 1st, a month later than the initial target, has been circulated as the new date to have the first state's recreational marijuana market up and running. But delays in federal background checks have put that timeline into question. As license holders anxiously await the go-ahead to bring safe and legal cannabis to Delawareans, and the state looks for a new marijuana commissioner, uncertainty looms over the recreational market. In part two of our Delaware's High Hope series, Delaware Public Media's Sarah Petrowich checked back in with license holders and discussed concerns over these delays with an industry advocate and the legislator behind the legalization of recreational marijuana.
Up until January, the Delaware Office of the Marijuana Commissioner maintained a fairly good pace with the timeline it set for itself in order to launch Delaware's recreational marijuana market by this spring. The office awarded its final set of licenses in December, which included 15 retail dispensary permits for the entire state. There were over 529 applicants competing for those licenses. State Representative Ed Ozinski, who led legislative efforts to create the recreational industry and remains a stakeholder in the process, says the next step has been conducting federal background checks on all of the license holders. Once holders clear their federal background checks, they will be issued an official conditional license and granted an 18-month period to become fully operational in the first state. But in his talks with Acting Marijuana Commissioner Paul Hyland, Representative Ozinski learned those checks are not being completed at the anticipated rate.
It's in the legislation that we drafted and passed that every applicant would have to complete that background check to make sure they don't have any criminal history and drug dealing and different things like that. So we need that national background check that the FBI performs. He said that's been a delay, and I can imagine what's been happening in Washington with the new administration in Washington and the layoffs and elimination of jobs with the FBI. I can see this dragging on. So I've actually started looking at ways that we can maybe deal with that.
Representative Ozinski says while the office still ultimately needs the background checks, he's looking into the option of having license holders sign affidavits stating they do not have any criminal history in order to move the process along. He says if the background checks come through and unveil an undisclosed history, license holders could potentially lose their permits after the fact.
I have heard what I've been hearing the concerns. I know it's delaying what we were hoping to see by now. So I'm definitely looking into what we need to do to maybe get around this just temporarily, but still hold true to the law and the requirements.
And those concerns only grow as a potential significant revenue source for the state is put on hold amid serious economic concerns, and license holders are unable to see a return on the thousands of dollars they invested to obtain their permits. Tracy Sutherland holds the state's only testing lab social equity license with permits for Newcastle County and Sussex County. When we spoke with her in December, she was the owner and operator of a trucking and logistics company. She says that business has since gone under due to extreme repairs needed for her fleet, and while she's fine now, she thought by this time her testing facility would be well on its way to getting up and running.
It's like a double-edged sword. I'm not blaming it on that. Like, if the trucking company was still going, I wouldn't be as strapped, but my timeline, I expected the lab to be gearing up, and I'm I still got little bit saved to keep me afloat, but it's like the timeline that I thought was going to happen isn't happening anymore.
As a social equity applicant, Tracy had to either have resided for at least 5 of the preceding 15 years in an area with high rates of marijuana arrests, been convicted of a marijuana-related offense, or have a family member who was convicted of a marijuana-related offense. Tracy happened to meet 2 of the 3 criteria and was able to apply for her licenses at a reduced rate, but she explained she still had to shell out a lot of money up front.
I do not try to take like the pity is me, but I'm starting to feel like, man, they really set social equity applicants up for failure because you're a social equity applicant, so you already are assuming that they're, disproportionately impacted, don't have all the advantages, and then you had them still pay. Like I've put out like 15,000 total because I also did apply for manufacturing licenses. My husband, not me, because I could only apply for one or the other, but just considering our money together, and we didn't get that either. So in total, I did about 15,000, and that's a lot of money.
She says the application and license fees have kept her from having the funds to retain a lawyer or an accountant to be able to attract investors. And while she should be receiving a social equity grant soon, she worries it's not enough.
We wanted to take advantage of the social equity opportunity. But all it did is kind of drain our pockets. As of right now, I'm hopeful that it'll still end up being better. But even the social equity grant, they're giving you $175,000 grant for a business that you need like 2 million to start. I was like, what if I need $100 and you gave me 50 cents, I'm probably not gonna say thank you. I'm gonna be like, what else? Like, where's the rest of the help?
The funding for the social equity grant program came from fees collected by conversion licenses. Although not initially a part of Delaware's recreational marijuana industry framework, legislators passed a bill last year allowing existing medical marijuana dispensaries to also sell recreationally for a hefty $200,000 fee. While those licenses have already been granted, medical dispensaries are not allowed to start selling recreationally until a number of new recreational dispensaries are open for business to try and maintain competitiveness. But Executive Director of the Delaware Cannabis Advocacy Network, Zoe Patchell, remains concerned about the business-related threats allowing medical dispensaries to grow and sell recreationally could pose to the new market.
Not one new business received a license in cultivation, manufacturing, and retail, which is what the vertically integrated model that the medical marijuana dispensaries are allowed to operate within. So the medical marijuana licenses have a number of unfair competitive advantages that the new businesses are not offered, including a larger grow canopy. So they'll have a larger area to cultivate, which of course allows them to cultivate at a lower cost than new businesses that only have a smaller area to cultivate in that space.
Proponents of conversion licenses argue it would allow an established industry to begin selling cannabis products to new retailers while other cultivators get off the ground, but only time will tell as the entire industry remains gridlocked. Kirsten McGuigan holds a Sussex County cultivation license with her husband, Andrew Kleinstuber. While she says the delays are certainly disappointing, they've allowed for more preparation time that the couple hopes helps them hit the ground running when conditional licenses are issued.
In some ways, it's been obviously a little bit frustrating because we just don't know. We don't have a timeline. But on the other hand, for us as the smaller producer, it's been able to give us just a little more time almost to get things like up and going before the market actually starts. So just on our end, that means site preparation, construction, things like that. So it has given us a chance for that end, but obviously we can't actually go ahead and be cultivating until everything is open. So obviously we're eager for the market to go ahead and open up.
Kirsten's family operates a seasonal restaurant she says the couple could fall back on if they can't make a livelihood right off the bat with cannabis cultivation. And she and Andrew also own forest flower orchards in Dagsboro, providing a diversified crop source. While Dagsboro opted to ban marijuana business entirely, and Sussex County has implemented a 3-mile buffer zone between marijuana sites and sensitive locations, such as churches, schools, and rehab centers, Kirsten and Andrew's farm falls outside town limits and does not violate the 3-mile radius. The enacting recreational marijuana legislation allows towns to completely ban marijuana business if they so choose, while it does not allow the same for the counties, zoning restrictions are up for grabs. Virtually every town in Sussex County has opted to ban cannabis business, and some Kent and Newcastle municipalities have followed suit. While Tracy thinks she has finally settled on a location in Newark after pivoting from Middletown following their shutdown of marijuana-related business, she's advocating for legislative change to help relieve some of the location restrictions.
Other people, they are still very much struggling because there's nowhere to go. And the very few places that there are, they're going to be so expensive. The maps, like there's a map for Newcastle County, there's a map for Sussex County. The few places, it's not possible. So we did the rally to set a rec open date, but also to fix the zoning issues. And because a lot of the legislators were just shocked by the map.
Perhaps the most surprising of considerations is from the city of Wilmington, which just opted for a 3-month dispensary ban while it mulls over regulation possibilities. The consensus from the city council and Mayor John Carney, who let recreational marijuana become law without his signature during his tenure as governor, appears to be that the 90 days will allow the city to properly consider its own zoning requirements. But an ordinance introduced by Council President Trippy Congo, with the support of at least two other council members, would ban marijuana business in the city completely, which Zoe reiterates is one of the state's largest areas disproportionately impacted by marijuana prohibition.
Banning legal licensed and regulated businesses within city limits will only make it less safe for the communities and consumers, and it'll certainly compound current problems like over-enforcement and continued illicit market activity that we're seeing in Wilmington. And it's really a shame because instead of embracing legalization, Wilmington is actually continuing enforcement.
While Representative Ozinski says the state does not plan to try and override any of the citywide bans, there is legislation in the works that would alter how far countywide buffer zones can go.
Senator Pardee has informed me that he is working on legislation to kind of equal the zoning requirements in each county so they would all look similar instead of having different, more like the way it is for alcohol. Instead of having all these different zoning requirements and restrictions to make them more in line. So I know he's working on that. We should be seeing something soon from him, I hope, on that.
The city of Wilmington also sent a formal request to the General Assembly asking for a direct cut of the proceeds from the 15% state tax on cannabis products. As outlined in the state's marijuana law, 7% of revenues will go into the Justice Reinvestment Fund for criminal justice reform work. After that appropriation and covering any overhead costs, remaining profits will be distributed at the discretion of the General Assembly, with the idea of some trickling down to the cities. Representative Ozinski argues Wilmington has the most to gain from the Justice Reinvestment Fund as a disproportionately impacted area. He says he's not interested in looking into a specific revenue carve-out for Wilmington, especially while they're considering a ban that could keep them from generating any sort of profit for the city.
The city of Wilmington, more so than other municipalities, they have a wage tax. So not allowing these businesses to operate within the city boundaries, they're missing out on the wage tax that would create. And of course, any licensing fee. All municipalities would have licensing fee for any businesses that operate in their jurisdiction. And Wilmington has been known as a business-friendly municipality. And here's a legal business that I think would benefit greatly to be located in certain sections of the city. And they're not even giving them an opportunity.
While Wilmington continues to mull over its recreational marijuana plans, Representative Ozinski says the state is also working hard to get back on track. In addition to his potential affidavit plan to temporarily work around the background check process, Representative Ozinski says the governor's office is currently in the process of finding a new marijuana commissioner following the resignation of Rob Koop in January. Prior to his stepping down, Commissioner Koop signaled that opening the market could take an additional month or two into the summer.
I hope it's not that far back. I mean, I really want this to be closer. The mentioning of April was just a goal. And I've heard a lot of people say, oh, that's what the date was. And it's like, not, well, there was a date set out there, but it was just a goal to try to reach. So it doesn't look like it's going to happen April 1st, but I hope it happens soon after. And if we can address this background check phase of it, then I think this thing can move quite quickly to get the market open.
Sarah Petrowich, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Sarah. And the Green continues in a moment with a closer look at how school suspensions disproportionately affect students of color and carry lasting consequences for their futures. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Each year, millions of students are suspended from public schools, a long-standing disciplinary practice that research shows often fails to improve behavior and disproportionately harms students of color. Last school year, about 14% of Delaware students received suspensions, with students of color facing out-of-school suspensions at higher rates, according to the state's annual report on school discipline improvement. In his new book, Suspended Education, School Punishment and the Legacy of Racial Injustice, University of Delaware sociology and criminal justice professor Aaron Kupchick explores how these disciplinary practices are tied to racial inequality and have long-lasting consequences for students. Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon sat down this week with Kupchick for more on suspended education and why school suspensions may do more harm than good.
There's been a lot of discourse recently around school discipline and student behavior here in Delaware and across the country, making suspended education about as timely as can be. And spoiler alert for our listeners out there, suspending kids out of school is, in nearly all cases, a bad idea, no matter what time period we are living in. And that's where I want to start things off. Why has suspension always been a commonly used disciplinary tactic throughout time?
Yeah, I began doing research for this book with a similar question in mind, which is why do we use it so frequently right now? Because as you said, in most cases, it doesn't help the student, it doesn't improve behavior, it doesn't help student learning for the other students, it doesn't help the school long-term, certainly doesn't help parents or communities. So how would this come about? And I look back and what I found was that before desegregation of schools, we didn't really use it very frequently at all. So it wasn't always used, but in the decades after the Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court decision that resulted in school desegregation across the U.S., that's when it started being used. So I did some intense research in a few different sites. One of them was Newcastle County, Delaware, and found that suspension only became common as Black students entered formerly all-white schools, and they were relatively unwanted there. And so school decision makers kicked them out by suspending them.
Yeah, and that racial component, that very strong racial component here, all of what we're talking about is essentially rooted in systemic racism. I do want to note the U.S. Government Accountability Office reported recently that Black girls receive more frequent and harsher discipline in school than other girls. And the same goes for Black girls in Delaware, according to a State of Our Union report that one of our reporters, Abigail Lee, recently revisited here on The Green. But we didn't need either report to tell us what history has already shown with why Black students of any gender are disproportionately suspended. Can you just touched on it, Aaron. Can you dig a little deeper into why Black kids are disproportionately suspended and suspended for the same kinds of misbehaviors as their fellow white classmates?
Yeah, there are a variety of different reasons why in the contemporary, so why today they're disciplined more frequently than white students. One of them, unfortunately, is implicit racial bias. And here, this is a term that's often used and often misunderstood. It doesn't mean that people are ill-intended. It means that we're human beings and we all carry around with us our own biases and preferences that we might not even know. So implicit racial bias refers to that momentary, very quick reaction where somebody might be a little more nervous or feel threatened by a Black student than a white student, where they might be a little quicker to assume bad intent by a Black student than a white student. You know, this implicit racial bias affects everyone. And so that's one reason. Another reason is that has to do with where people go to school. And schools that tend to house more students of color are often under-resourced, have a lot more problems at stake in terms of the issues they have to confront on a daily basis, and they tend to be more punitive.
And there are some rather significant implications here. Suspension doesn't end at the single act of suspending a student. So what are these kids up against? What exactly do they face as, you know, as far as risks or implications go if they find themselves suspended?
So if we think first and foremost about what it's intended to address, which is behavior, students who get suspended tend to act out more in the future, not less. So it backfires in terms of correcting their behavior. And, you know, you might say, well, it helps a teacher do their job, right? So maybe that's a secondary or equal to the first goal. If I'm a teacher and I'm trying to teach to a class of 35 students and one is making that difficult, well, I want to get rid of them, at least for a few days. But what research finds is that high suspension schools actually have worse average test scores than lower suspension schools, even when other things like school demographics and student behavior are similar. So it's not actually helping student learning and teacher's ability to teach for the rest of the class. For the student that gets suspended, though, more directly to your question, not only does behavior get worse, they suffer academic penalties, meaning that they're missing class and they're marked as a bad student and they're less likely to succeed in school, less likely to graduate, more likely to be held back a grade. Down the road, we can see consequences. Students who get suspended out of school are at greater risk of arrest, eventual incarceration. There are all sorts of problems. And in a study several years ago, a colleague and I even found that students who get suspended are less likely to vote and volunteer in their communities 15 to 20 years later.
Right. Well, the ripple effects here are pretty clear. They're wide ranging, meaning parents and families are also touched by this, which is something, you know, you mentioned. But what does that impact exactly look like for families?
A number of years ago, Colleen and I, we looked into this in some depth. We interviewed dozens of families from in a school district down south whose children had been suspended from school long term and even expelled. And what we found was that those families really paid the price, man. They really suffered. We talked to parents who lost their jobs because of having to miss work so many times to pick their kids up from school. And keep in mind, if your child gets suspended out of school, that means you get a phone call saying, come down here right now to pick them up. A day or two later, you likely also have to attend a meeting at the school to discuss the behavior. And then a day or two after that, you have to accompany them back. That's for one incident. And these were all families whose kids had been involved in many incidents. And because low-income families are at greater risk of going through all of this, the people we talked to were primarily lower wage earners, often minimum wage, who don't have the job security and the ability to tell their boss, I have to take off for 3 hours and I'll be right back. You know, the boss will find somebody else most likely. So we talked to people who lost their jobs. We talked to people who became separated. I mean, I spoke to a couple families who sent their child to live with relatives in another state so that child could continue to get an education. We spoke to families who had internal family conflict with one child taking up so much of the attention and energy, that caused problems. We spoke to some who literally had developed mental health and even physical health problems because of the stress of dealing with it.
All this being said, then, what positives, if any, can we point to in suspending a student? Is there anything that we can tangibly, you know, hang our hats on as far as the positives go?
That is a more difficult question to answer. If a student is being violent and is causing harm or is at risk of real risk of causing harm to other students, then I believe it makes sense to remove them from the school. But what the data show are that we don't have that many cases that are that serious, right? And so most of our suspensions don't need to be resulting in a suspension. Most of the incidents that result in suspension could be something that result in a more restorative and less punitive consequence. So are there any instances where it is productive? I wouldn't say the word productive, but I would say necessary, perhaps.
I do want to note that in Delaware, a task force in charge of finding solutions to the state's student behavior and school climate issues delivered its final recommendations in the fall following these increasing reports of student behavior incidents and issues around absenteeism. It does remain to be seen how effective those recommendations will be, but how do we solve this then, Aaron? Is it through improved teacher training to handle conflicts better and to meet kids where we're at? I know we touched on that. Do we need, these maybe separate third party, special third party groups to come in and handle certain conflicts? Do laws and policy need to change? Is this answer D, it's all of the above kind of thing. I know you also write that we need to recognize how we got here, if we want to go forward and fix today's problems, recognizing this history and how this is so deeply rooted in systemic racism. So how does this issue get addressed?
Well, first of all, the broader term that you just mentioned is exactly right. We live in an era where many believe it's more comforting to put our heads in the sand and pretend that we live in a world where horrible things haven't happened. And that's not true. And those horrible things like segregation and resistance to desegregation, they have an impact today. And that doesn't mean it's anybody's fault today. And that doesn't mean that people should feel bad about it. It means we just need to clearly open our eyes and recognize why we are where we are so that we can do better for our children. In terms of what kinds of practices would do better, there are a whole host of different practices that can help. Nothing's going to magically fix it, particularly because student misbehavior is a real problem. And kids come to school, particularly today, 5 years after the start of the pandemic, they come to school with so many problems and complicated lives that a teacher can't fix, but the student takes it out on the teacher often. I have great empathy for teachers dealing with this on the front lines today. So we're not going to fix everything is one thing we have to realize. But what we can do is make progress by better supporting teachers first and foremost. We also can implement practices like restorative justice or positive behavioral interventions and supports in ways that are implemented with fidelity, meaning that they actually follow the program as it's designed, not an add-on that a school wants to claim they do this program. And so they suspend a kid and then have a 10-minute meeting with them. So there are a variety of different programs that we can use. All of them follow common threads. And to really boil it down quite a bit, that common thread is that they see students as children to be cared for, not problems to be managed. And they really seek to help children solve the problems that cause the misbehavior, rather than seeing the misbehavior as just something that is part of them and they need to be excluded.
Thanks to UD Sociology and Criminal Justice Professor Aaron Kupchick, author of the new book Suspended Education, and R. Kyle McKinnon for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, Arts Playlist, where we head to the Mezzanine Gallery at the Carvel State Building in Wilmington for a look at a new exhibit inspired by a local artist's old family photo album. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. An old family photo album can be a window into the past, but for local artist Virginia Lockman, it became something more. In her latest exhibition, Figments, Lockman reimagines vintage family photographs through digital collages, blending them with birds, animals, and celestial elements to create dreamlike images. The exhibition is on view in the Mezzanine Gallery at the Carvel State Building in Wilmington through March 28th. And in this week's Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny is joined by Lachman for a closer look at Figments and how her art transforms memory into storytelling.
Tell me about your background and how you started your journey to becoming an artist.
Oh, well, I guess there's always a little bit of artist in everybody all along. But I bought a camera about 12 years ago and as something to do, learned how to photograph and became more interested in what I was photographing than how. So I'm not a gear freak.
Can you describe your artwork that's on display and how it came about?
The artwork on display is called Figments. It's a series of collages, digital collages, that started with old photographs. So I inherited an album of photographs of my father and his family when they lived outside of Wilmington in the early 1900s. And I was struck by the people in the book, some of whom I knew and some of whom I didn't, and started to make actual paper collages, but felt frustrated by the limitations. For this project. So I started to make them digitally, which let me incorporate a lot of other elements and work with different sizes and things.
I wonder if you could tell me about one or two photos that are particularly meaningful to you.
One is Aunt Caroline. So it's a portrait of a woman, probably in the 1800s, I don't know. And it hung in our house when I was growing up, and my brother has it. When I was visiting him one day a couple years ago, I took a picture of it and decided to use it. And the pictures start with an idea or a pairing. She's very dark, and I added a cage, and then I put a young child in the cage, and I added a bird, and it's sort of dark, but it's evocative of a period, I guess, and it still strikes me. I know very little bit about Caroline. The story is that she was single and she lived with my grandparents or my great-grandparents at some point. She lived with someone in my family and nobody knows much about her. And I don't know, it's sort of lonely and sad, but it's strong.
You touched on this a little bit, but I wonder if you could kind of take me through your creative process, how you go from finding a pairing to executing a work of art.
It's sort of intuitive. It almost has a life of its own. And something about the image strikes me, and as I start to put things together, it just sort of takes on a life of its own, even though I'm subconsciously factoring in things like balance and composition and possibly a storyline if it gets going in my head. And sometimes, you know, I'll do one and I'll feel dissatisfied and I'll add to it later, or sometimes I'll know there was something there to work with and I'll just sort of start over. And sometimes it works the first time.
It seems like you're kind of describing the technical aspects as almost being like subconscious or muscle memory and kind of letting your creative brain really sort of drive the bus when you're putting those works together.
I think that's right. I started doing these as sort of a brain exercise, a creative exercise. Most of my photography is landscape and what you would call straight photography. And this let me use a whole different bunch of creative muscles.
How many works are on display?
There are 17 in the current exhibit.
And what do you hope that viewers will take away from seeing your work?
Well, you know, it's always hard to imagine what somebody else will see in it because it's so much something that comes out of me. But I think people see their own stories, their own, they identify with it somehow and make up their own interpretation.
What are you working on now?
Oh, I don't know. I'm sort of at a, sort of taking a pause. Doing an exhibit takes a lot of energy. I'm still working on, this is sort of an ongoing project. I mean, periodically, that's what I do. But now that it's getting to be spring, I think I'll get outside and start photographing again and see what happens with those images. Sometimes I use my own images with the collage images.
Thanks to Wilmington artist Virginia Lockman and our Martin Matheny for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. Lockman's exhibition, Figments, is on view at the Mezzanine Gallery at the Carvel State Building in Wilmington through March 28th. And we close out the green next with Enlighten Me and a conversation with Delaware's only certified professional organizer, Kim Mazuski, about the benefits of spring cleaning and why it's about more than just simply tidying up. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Flowers are starting to bloom, the birds are singing, and your closets are overflowing. That means spring is here, and so is the time to clean, declutter, and finally tackle that junk drawer. But where do you start? According to Delaware's only certified professional organizer, Kim Mazuski, it's best to begin with small, manageable tasks and build from there so you can create lasting habits that make a real difference in your home. In this edition of Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon spoke with Mazuski about how small changes can lead to big results and why spring cleaning is about more than just your space. It's about finding peace of mind.
A lot of folks out there, I'm sure cringe when they hear spring cleaning and decluttering. Objectively, I don't think it sounds like an enjoyable process, though it can be, and it can feel incredibly rewarding when you're done. From your view, Kim, why do so many of us struggle with clutter and basic upkeep of, you know, our home and the stuff that is in our home? Are we just lazy procrastinators, or is there more to it?
Oh my gosh, absolutely not. That is definitely a misconception, and people blame that as something that gets in the way of the process. But I like to think of spring cleaning as like a waking up. Right. So if you think of bears coming out of hibernation, like we're groggy, we're like ready to get back into it. Okay. So like we're going to like open the windows up a little bit and we're going to put fresh eyes on our home. And what I like to say is that, you know, no one intends to have clutter. No one wants this kind of overwhelm. No one wants to feel this way. I mean, every person that calls me for their intro is like, I feel stuck. I feel paralyzed. I feel overwhelmed. I feel like I have no idea where to begin. And so when we're looking at spring cleaning, we're looking at trying to come into your home, into your spaces with an open mind and a curious kind of investigative approach. Like, what's going on? What do I see in here? And how did this happen? Right? It's not like somebody came with a dump truck of crap and just toss it into your house, right? These things trickle in. I mean, you're probably not getting 30, you know, Amazon packages every day. It's one or two here and there. And it's, you know, it's the things like hand-me-downs that people are giving. It's the gifts from family members that you don't need. You know, it's the party favors that are coming in. It's just everyday life is throwing stuff at us. And when you are a person who's doing the best you can, right? Whether you are, working, parenting, all of the above, or whatever it is, like we are tired. We're working really hard. And so sometimes you come home and you just shift into like autopilot and you go through the motions of your routine. And there's a lot of, you know, I'll deal with this later, or, you know, there's a lot of crap on the counter. So I'm just going to put it in a bin and put it in the basement. That's not decluttering. Okay. That's just making the problem worse for later. But like we do these things to do a quick fix, but there's not really a quick fix. And so when we talk about spring cleaning, it's asking you to slow down, take it one room at a time, one space at a time, and start small. So for example, picking your nightstand and just clearing off the top, you know, what can be thrown away? What can be recycled? What can be donated or sold or relocated? And just starting there and building up those small wins.
Small wins. Yeah, I like that. And I think it's especially, you know, poignant where we don't overwhelm ourselves, or else we'll never, you know, that's part of why we're putting it off, because we're overwhelming ourselves as well. And, you know, it's also not just tidying up. It's a legitimate deep dive into your stuff, right? Your space. And there are a lot of benefits and net positives that come with that. We touched on that off air beforehand. And I think that's something as far as those net positives, those benefits, I don't think those ever really get talked about when it comes to spring cleaning and decluttering. So what are your thoughts on that then, Kim? You know, the mental and emotional benefits of a deep clean and of a successful decluttering?
That's a great question. The benefits of decluttering are not just fluff. I mean, this is like research backed, consistently proven by science that it really helps to reduce anxiety and depression. It cuts down on cortisol levels, which in women, the stress of clutter is elevated extra. And so that can cause a lot of health problems, right? So we're bringing down that stress hormone. We're also cutting back on tension in relationships. A lot of my couples are fighting because one person is more organized than the other. This is a great way to come together and work as a team, right? And then there's less isolation. There's less shame. You're happy to have people over. We notice improved focus and decreased distractibility. And you see this for your own, you know, work, but also for your kids when they're doing homework, when you're trying to do something as a family. We see fewer behaviors in kids, fewer adverse behaviors, which is huge, right? And also when kids have fewer things to play with, they show more creativity. You know, they're thinking outside the box. They are improving their independent play. So there's just so many goals, not to mention like you're saving time and money and energy in the long run because you're taking inventory of your home.
Yeah, it sounds like a decluttered home is indeed a happy home. Well, where do we start then here? What's the first step in getting organized and decluttering? What does that look like?
If you read any book or if you follow any expert or influencer, the first step is honestly just knowing your why. Why is this important to you? And also, I like to think that it has to do with self-worth, right? So knowing in your core that you deserve a space that you can manage, that's restful, that feels calming to you. And that's like, you can come home and like let out a sigh of relief because life is really hard. Life is crazy stressful. There's a lot going on right now that's outside of our control. We want to come home and feel good. And it's hard to do that when there's clutter here, clutter here, clutter here, clutter here, because that is just more mental, like, burden, more red flags in your head of like, you have more to do. I'm not in control of my house. I'm overwhelmed. It kind of reinforces that narrative. So we have to shift from, I don't know where to start, or I'm too far gone, or I'm just a messy person. Like, this is just who I am, because those things are just not true. This process is about moving forward, and you're not going to have an Instagram worthy home from a weekend of decluttering. It just doesn't work like that. This is, you're undoing a lifetime of routines and learned behaviors, and you're trying to make better choices. And so it's all about those small wins. Like I'm saying, start really small. And, you know, I always tell my clients, like, part of why we're successful when we work together is because you took this day off work. You put it on the calendar. You planned around it. You prioritized this as something that was going to happen. We came in with a focus. We were going to do your primary bedroom closet. Okay. That's all we're doing. We have 6 hours to work on the closet, and that's enough time when you have an organizer who's a professional and super passionate. But like, also, we can even break it down into smaller steps if you're going to DIY. So maybe your goal is to clear everything off the floor in the closet. Just clear the floor in the closet, make it more accessible, make it easier to get in there, give you a reason to be excited about going in a little bit deeper. And so I like to say to make that commitment to yourself by, you know, holding yourself accountable, having it on the calendar. Some people like to have a body double. So they'll say to their best friend or their sister, you know what, come over, you can drink a glass of wine. I need to, you know, go through my filing cabinet. Just keep me on task. It's about committing to that time, giving yourself permission to just go all in and, you know, start small, 15 minutes. You can do a junk drawer. You can clear something. Start small. And what usually happens is the timer goes off and you feel damn good because you've accomplished something and you see a difference right away. That visible change is huge and you feel that relief instantly.
I love that. There's such a strong self-care component here, but then thinking about everything, like whether it's your stuff or your space, and just being so purposeful, it sounds like. Yeah, I really love that. And as far as those clients go who may be, you know, really yearning to hold on to, you know, sentimental items for whatever reason, how do you help them let go of those? Like, let go as in either let go of them completely or you know, shift them in another space or whatnot. What about that?
Oh my gosh, I can't believe you want me to talk about decluttering sentimental items in this tiny little podcast. That's hilarious. That's like an hour-long conversation minimum. I guess what I'll say just as quick as I can is that we don't start there, right? You have to start with easy stuff. You have to start with trash and recycling because you don't have that attachment to it. Part of why when you hire an organizer like me, I come in and I'm this neutral third party that's unbiased. I have no attachment to your stuff. I literally don't care. People are like, are you going to force me to get rid of anything? Absolutely not. Am I going to hold you accountable to your goals to have a space that feels relaxing and not overwhelming? Yes. And I'll push back when I can. But we start with the easy things so that you get confident making small choices. And we build up that muscle, that knowing of yourself to say, I know myself to know that I'm okay without this. I know that my things do not define who I am. And you can love something and honor it and let it go with gratitude to know that it's going to have new life. I just had a keyboard that was so beautiful and it sounded incredible. And my wife bought it for me 2 years ago. And I said, I don't think you should buy it for me because what if I don't play it? I didn't play it. And then I said, you know what? Let's find a new home for it where someone's going to really love it. So we donated it to a nonprofit and they're so happy. So it's like knowing that your things served you well at the time, they were meaningful to bring in, and also it's okay to let them go.
Thanks to Delaware's only certified professional organizer, Kim Mazuski, and our Kyle McKinnon for enlightening us this week. And that'll do it for this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny, Sarah Petrowich, and our senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a First State of Mind.